This is Scenic Roads Talking Writing. Our guest is Benjamin Law, whose second book has just been published, titled The Secret Life of Groceries. It begins with a description of the bi-monthly cleanup of a seafood counter in a Whole Foods store, before travelling across the country and to Asia, uncovering the real cost of the abundance on our supermarket shelves. That wealth of choices reportedly planted the seeds for the fall of communism in Russia after Boris Yeltsin, the president of the Soviet Union at the time, visited a supermarket in the late 1980s and was stunned by the abundance. The New York Times called the book, which took 5 years to complete, a deeply curious and even-handed report on our national appetites, while another reviewer called it at once a satisfying, enjoyable meal and a glass of cold water to the face. I was thinking about the way your book is organized, and I thought it was kind of interesting that it makes sense, really, that you kind of go from the source for most of us to the source for the source. So you go from the street level, this is how food comes to us, and this is where it comes from, and it makes perfect sense. The first thing that occurred to me when thinking about your book was how you would even begin to organize something like this, because as is evidenced just by the number of them, supermarkets are ubiquitous.
Yes. Completely ubiquitous. 38,000 of them across the U.S. We're spending such a huge volume of money in them, you know, $700 billion in 2018. Getting a handle on the volume and the scale of the industry was absolutely one of my number one concerns, and thinking about how am I going to possibly get a piece of this beast of an industry into something like a narrative form. I think we talk about our food system in really odd and kind of schizophrenic terms a lot of times. We either think about it as this like greedy for-profit agribusiness that is serving us up plastic food and we're completely beholden to it, or there's like food writing that is kind of like paeonic, mythic, kind of like waxing poetic about some mythic roasts that's out there. And I really wanted to position this in between those in a way that talks about the system in a way that it operates in our lives and a way that we are in control. You know, say what you will about the critique of these giant, faceless, greedy agribusinesses, and there's a lot of truth to it, but the grocery store doesn't operate like that. It has 1.5 to 3.5% margins and is there bending over on both knees to serve consumers. And so that's just a really valuable entry point in thinking about the pressures that are on these corporations, and they're not always operating on our behalf, but occasionally they are, and the mixed messages we send them can make life really tricky.
I can only imagine. I thought it was interesting that you spent quite a lot of time talking about Trader Joe's. To be honest with you, it's somewhat inexplicable to me. In fact, I got into rather a heated conversation with my wife about why Trader Joe's is so popular. She didn't think there was any question as to why that was. Personally, we don't have a Trader Joe's here in Chattanooga. They've been rumored and people have been asking for it. Amazing, really, when you think about that. The people would request a supermarket, you know, locate in town. But that's something that, for as long as I can remember, people have been talking about. What's the deal with Trader Joe's? The whole thing seems to be completely counterintuitive. He's not even a grocery store guy, Joe Cologne.
I completely agree with you. And I started this with your skepticism to a T. I shop at Trader Joe's occasionally, but certainly don't think I fall into the cult of Trader Joe's. And yet I was acutely aware it existed. And it was one of the formative things in this book. Actually, my previous book was on the Bikram Yoga world. And it was kind of looking at this yoga cult. It went to pretty dark places with this guru who was kind of sexually assaulting his practitioners. But during that book, I went to one of his teacher trainings and I saw all these yogis descend into a Trader Joe's and they just had this maniacal glee. You know, it's like they were going to an amusement park when they were going grocery shopping. And then there was something about the chain. The employees were happy, seemingly really well paid relative to other grocery stores. The items on the shelf seemed like they were cheaper than a lot of places, and they were seemingly high quality. And in my head, I didn't understand how this all added up, and I really wanted to understand. I was happy to report, after spending time with Joe, the Trader Joe, for the book, Joe Cologne, who founded the chain in late 1950s, that there were good reasons for that. He really was kind of a visionary in thinking about what a grocery store could be. And one of the interesting things is why it might not appeal to you or to some people and why it might. He targeted consumers. He created an archetypical Trader Joe's consumer and then really built the chain around that. This was this kind of overeducated, underpaid, some people qualify them as like a Volvo driving professor, but somebody who was just coming into their own in terms of exploring the world. And you think about when he was starting this in the late 1950s, it was a time when travel was really expanding, international travel. The GI Bill was hitting another generation of people. So people who hadn't previously been able to get into college were now becoming educated, and educated meaning they were exposed to new vocabularies. And they wanted to flex all of those muscles in the grocery store. And he built a chain that would allow them to indulge in those things and indulge their curiosity, which was frankly not something that most grocery stores at that time and to this day do. They kind of were bombing out Coca-Cola and Bounty and the same continuously mass-produced products you see everywhere. He kind of sidestepped that game and told his buyers to focus on more unique products or products that would appeal particularly to that the demographic that he was targeting.
Which is interesting in as much as, you know, he was doing that in the late 50s, early 60s, because it seems to me that he anticipated what is often leveled as a criticism for the generation that came of age in the 80s and 90s, where they are sort of hyper-selective about everything.
Yes, yeah, totally. By a decade, he anticipated that. For him, it came from just pure observation. He was a great humanist, I think, and he really was able to connect the dots between a lot of things. But he was looking at network TV share. In the late 60s, network TV was just this big homogenous media landscape where you were kind of told what you should like, and it was all supported by manufacturers. And he just had a sense that that media landscape wasn't sustainable. And of course, he was 100% right. I mean, he didn't know that the internet was coming. He didn't think people would want to march in lockstep, and they would want their own individual ways of approaching the world. And he decided he would create a grocery store to serve that.
And yet at the same time, we have IKEA and Aldi, which
yeah.
seem to operate on just that model. But the interesting thing to me about the story you're telling is you start out, you know, with what we all imagined to be the way a grocery store was in the late 19th century, where there's a man in an apron behind the counter and everything is very personalized. Seems like that's the same model that Joe was drawing on. And so there's, you know, there's this kind of dichotomy throughout your book between personalized service and the necessary automation of mass marketing.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. The complicating factor would be in that 19th century general store, which is like the precursor to the grocery store, products, there wasn't the packaging technology. Products were more anonymous and generic by default. So you get these big barrels of preserved fruit that people would chisel out of, and you'd get, there were some canned goods, but they weren't necessarily branded products. It was only with the rise of packaging and the invention of the cardboard box, which is one of these things that, you know, it should be right up there with the wheel in terms of like a civilization-changing invention, that you get products individually packaged, demanding a label and demanding a name on that label. And that creates a movement towards choice and discernment. And of course, a PR marketing apparatus that builds up around it, which becomes the modern advertising industry. And so that shift happens before Trader Joe gets involved, and he kind of mediates those forces, I think, in a really interesting way. He obviously takes advantage of the marketing and the individuation, but he does harken back to the kind of simpler time where every other grocery store in the country, essentially, was trying to grow as big as they possibly could. Because at heart, grocery is a volume game. It's a low-margin industry, and you want to sell as much as you possibly can. That's where you're making your money. To do that, they offer tons and tons of products. These superstores have 100,000 different individual products, which, if you're a buyer at one of those stores, is just too much to be comprehensible. And so what Joe did was he shrunk his offerings down to a human scale, only a few thousand different products, which was heresy at the time. Like his internal staff thought the chain would fail. But it allowed his buyers to become experts over their categories that they managed, and it would allow them to select for this demographic, this underpaid, overeducated consumer that he was targeting in a much more strategic manner.
So it sounds a lot like the Whole Foods model, and yet he's twice as successful as Whole Foods.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's so many different things there. Whole Foods, in many ways, with their 365 brand, was trying to do a lot of what Trader Joe's did. And Whole Foods had a much harder job. And because Whole Foods, rather than overeducated, underpaid, they're really targeting a consumer that's ecologically conscious. So, you know, Mother Earth is kind of like the central, if you want to think on a branding level, around especially the original Whole Foods. And Whole Foods walked the walk more than just about anyone. The early Whole Foods had a big impact on what a grocery store could do, which gave them this whole paycheck, you know, that all cost money, gave them this whole paycheck reputation. They were publicly traded. The market didn't like that reputation. They wanted them to compete with places like Trader Joe's, which this became an impossibility. They were caught in a very frustrating place, which they solved by scaling up, 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 up. You don't get any bigger than Amazon, and that's who they partnered with, got bought by, and thus lost some of that Mother Earth. But they were in a real tricky place, and the book gets into some of that, especially towards the end, talking to some of the people who were real frustrated with the moves that Whole Foods was making as it started centralizing in the ways that led to the Amazon deal.
But it's a rapaciously competitive business. In order to be small in the sense that you're specialized, you have to be huge in order to compete, don't you?
Yeah, and the things that Whole Foods was doing really well and where they pioneered, they became almost a victim of their own success on some levels. They would nurture these small products in ways that other supermarkets do not do. It is very hard to break into the supermarket industry, and it's something that I didn't know going into this book, but the supermarkets often act like landlords, meaning that they rent out shelf space by the inches, and people are paying for their spot on the shelf. Products are paying for those inches. I'm not talking about end caps here or something that you already know people are paying for, but inches anywhere in the store. And they can be incredibly expensive. So if you're starting out as an entrepreneur, getting those inches is really difficult and maybe means partnering with venture capital. But for Whole Foods would nurture these and they would let them in and they would help them sample, but without being extractive about this. This is Whole Foods of 2 decades ago or even 1 decade ago. But as soon as those brands became big and they got established and they scaled up, they could then jump to competitors like Target, Walmart, and now Walmart's the number one seller of organic. And the qualities that Whole Foods was nurturing in them, they kind of lost to these bigger competitors. And as the organic sector got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, the edge that they had in terms of kind of an identity as a store was getting diluted by these other players. They decided they had to pivot away from it.
As you noted, you know, it's a grocery business is not about food. It's about marketing. And a grocery store is just a distribution center, isn't it? And they've got X square feet. It makes sense that they would say to whoever the seller is, well, we'll give you 50 square feet for whatever we can negotiate for, as a price.
That's right. You know, I had agribusiness consultants and manufacturers that I would talk to for this book, and they would say repeatedly, don't think of it as food. Think of it as food product. So some of them were like in the deep organic sector, marketing the most wholesome things that you could imagine, the kind of answers to Michael Pollan's demand for more real food. And yet they couldn't afford to think about it as food because that's not how the buyer was thinking about it. The buyer is thinking about it as a source of margin. The buyer is thinking about it, how can I position this on my shelf so that I steer people towards high margin products? How can I make sure that the commodities that underpin this are stable and so that my consumer isn't seeing the price jump around? And those qualities are definitely not things that, as a customer, you think about. The difficulty of getting a product to shelf was another one of these eye-opening things. I follow this entrepreneur, Julie Boucher, who's this incredibly hardworking, brilliant person who is trying to get her little baby, which is salsa, this combination coleslaw salsa, onto the grocery shelf. And the amount of effort it takes is just backbreaking. Because there are just so many different hurdles for a small player to break into the big game. It was really eye-opening just to watch someone work as hard as she was working.
And I think people locally would be fascinated by that story. Julie is from North Carolina, but she took the product from a man in Chattanooga who developed it from a family recipe, apparently, Judson Odom.
Yes, that's right. They partnered. It's kind of a relish. It's quite delicious, I think. I didn't want to feature any product that there was a lot of food entrepreneurs that I kind of looked at, and I decided I would only feature one that I actually thought their product was delicious. So I wasn't at some type of ethical conundrum. But she really took that and applied the perspiration required to get that onto shelf, and took it from a place where it's in a commercial kitchen to a place where it's able to be bombed out of a industrial kitchen or industrial manufacturing line with at scale. It's just a different ball game than we kind of imagine. We all, in the back of our heads, I think, have like our grandmother's great guacamole or some featured item we think we could kind of convert into a product on a shelf. And the truth is, there's just a lot more to it than having a dream. You have to know how to position it, market it, and connect to those retail buyers. And telling her story was really a highlight.
And it's cool that she maintained the Chattanooga connection.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
That is the way you offer all these insights through the story of an individual. Julie, as a person who is deeply and spending 24 hours a day, would be spending more if they existed in trying to get Slaughter on the shelves and succeeding. Then you talk to a person who probably carries boxes of Slaughter to stores across the country, Lynn Riles. She's a trucker. And I thought it was interesting that you focused on a woman, because from what I gather, trucking is a dangerous occupation at best, but for a woman has all kinds of other issues that maybe doesn't affect men as much.
Yeah, my eyes were completely widened. I think trucking exists in this parallel universe. We pass them on the highway. It's easy to imagine what's going on inside that cab, but what I had imagined prior to the book was a fantasy. The truckers, it is the most dangerous profession by death rate. More truckers die than any other profession. It's an incredibly hardworking job. You have to be vigilant on the road, otherwise you're going to be causing someone else to die. And yet, it is a grueling life, and too many of the truckers that I interviewed were kind of caught in what they would describe as sharecropping on wheels, in which you couldn't conceptualize any other way than debt peonage. And all of the pressures, as you noted, that any trucker would be subjected to are amplified in Lynn in the book, who's a woman, because I guess to back up, the reason these truckers get caught in this debt peonage is they get promised trucking as a middle class job, and they take out loans to get their commercial driver's license and then to become owner operator of their own vessel. And those loans can be used in manipulative ways, preventing them from working for another fleet, using only in-house counsel or in-house garage, or there's many different ways that debt can be used to manipulate the trucker. But often the young trucker is the most manipulated, and they're forced to kind of drive team with another person. And that means sharing your truck with another human being. And you're in a very small contained box driving continuously for hours on end. And if you're a woman who's paired with a man and you're both going through this realization that the life you stepped into isn't quite the life that you were promised, there's a lot of hostility there. And there's just a tremendous opportunity for abuse. And I talked to many female truckers, and they would say things like, if a woman told me she wasn't sexually harassed, assaulted, or had a man like attempt to rape her, I wouldn't believe her. Because that was how common it would be in the industry for that behavior to occur. And it's the type of thing I couldn't get hard stats on it, because I didn't find anyone else really looking at it. But the anecdotes, when you scratch the surface, would just come pouring out in a way. But again, it really changed how I see this like parallel world.
I understand. In some ways, it's an ongoing narrative of parallel worlds. I have to tell you, Ben, I wasn't a huge fan of chicken before I read your book. But once you describe the conditions in which those chickens are and raised, seems almost like it's not the right word. I don't know how you would describe the way a chicken is taken from the egg to what it is we see on the plate.
Yeah, it's industrial. And it's an interesting thing. I'm not a vegan. I'm not a vegetarian even. I struggled with that quite a bit. And I broke into caged egg facilities with an activist group so I could see it for my own eyes, and partly to understand exactly where the certification system that kind of guarantees ethical food works and where it fails us. But I was left very confused. precisely because it is an industrial product, and it's designed at a scale to feed our needs as a human species that are pretty unimaginable at an individual level. The appetite that we have as a species, it's just not something that our imaginations scale up to. And so you walk into these industrial farms, and it's not what I expected from years of like thinking of seeing vegan videos or videos designed to turn you vegan, of like some type of terrestrial hellscape with, you know, fecal matter everywhere and feathers and dust and birds that were like in various shapes of disease. It wasn't that. What it was very clean, very alienating, like death row accommodations for a massive amount of living sentient creatures that we were all going to eat. Can't really summarize it any more than that. I just leave that there, in that it was both troubling and a little bit, it left me feeling just what an awesome thing the human appetite is on a global scale. And like so many parts in the book, it really pointed that solutions to our problems aren't going to come from thinking about food. They're going to come from thinking about structural qualities way outside of food, whether that's population control or whether that's developing a safety net for laborers so they're free to leave abusive jobs, or whether that's developing trade treaties with enforcement teeth. Thinking about these things as food products almost always gets in the way of thinking about the solutions around them.
I'm trying to imagine what the experience of walking into a supermarket is for you now, Ben, after this deep dive.
It's a tough one. I think a gratitude is something that has been enhanced by an appreciation of the sacrifice, the effort, the ingenuity that has been poured into creating this environment that is a miraculous thing. You know, I think I was very acutely aware of that writing the book. And I think a lot of other people with COVID have really tapped into this notion that rather than this banal chore, going to the grocery store, we're deeply dependent on these institutions. They are vital sources for our life. And the minute that COVID threatened to, like, even hinted at disrupting that, people snapped to it and recognized, oh, these are essential workers. You know, they started using really sanctimonious phrases I don't like calling them heroes, but because they're, I mean, I don't call them heroes because they're forced to be heroes by class distinction, not because they're opting into that. But I walk through the grocery store now and I feel like my understanding of it has been broadened. Like there's extra room in my cranium to like think about it. The ceiling has kind of been raised into all of the feats that go into create this abundance. And then I think, how can we scale that back? And do we really need a miracle environment to feed ourselves? Or can we scale back the kind of greedy, selfish aspects that have gone into creating this like miraculous landscape?
That seems to be the subtext of your narrative. How do we humanize something that's become, in some ways, a kind of Frankenstein monster? Is that why you began by focusing on Trader Joe's? Because that seems to be what he was trying to do, too.
Yeah, you know, in many ways, I was narratively frustrated with where to put Trader Joe, because he exists in opposition to a lot of these qualities. And I should say that was Trader Joe, not necessarily Trader Joe's of today. Mm-hmm. I think they operate on a very similar DNA, very similar blueprint, but the design has been made more diffuse over the years, for sure, and it has become more similar to other grocery stores. But yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head in terms of both him being in opposition to it and me thinking this tension point between the scale it takes to feed us with the qualities we demand at checkout, which is low price, abundance, choice, high quality, are in tension with a lot of what I consider the best virtues of us as human beings, which creativity, community, caring, these forces that should bind us, and they're in opposition with each other. And so thinking of ways that we can build a better food system does involve more community, does involve more caring, does involve more curiosity and ways for interaction with our food. You know, I came to think that the thinking about it as food was a misplaced. These were solutions that were going to come from outside of that world. They were going to be solutions that came from thinking either about ourselves and our needs and grappling with that, or came from reinventing a lot of the structures, whether that's treating laborers as shareholders rather than as constituent parts, which too often they are, and reforming very policy-level things like creating wage floors and safety nets and thinking about global inequity as a driver for great migrations that then become very abusive when people become trafficked in those migrations. In the current system, a lot of the reasons these migrants get abused are because they're acting as agents of their own survival and traveling for work. You're not going to cure that through purchasing decisions at the grocery store. You're going to cure that by looking at global inequity and thinking about how to alleviate poverty across different countries. So the scale of the problem is immense, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
The scale of your book is immense, to take us back to where we started. How long did you spend writing this book and doing the research before you could even begin writing it?
Yeah, it was about 3 years of research and then 2 years of writing.
Wow.
And part of that is I'm a slow writer, and I want to be better at that. I have such awe for these journalists who can pump out amazingly readable things quickly, and that I'm a slow writer. I like to take my time with the words. But I took 3 years of real research in that sector, and I went, as I think you get the sense, pretty deep in some places in terms of just trying to be as experiential as possible, whether that's riding with a trucker, going to Thailand and Myanmar to visit with laborers who'd been trafficked and bought out of prison and imprisoned on seafood industry there, or again, breaking into factory farms with activists. I tried to make my research process as experiential as possible, but then once you have that, because it's all anecdote, you have to fit it into a kind of deeper, more rigorous structure by talking to the people who actually know, because the system is so big that your anecdotes are going to be very misleading if you don't frame them properly.
Well, it's really interesting to talk to you, Ben. Thanks so much for taking so much time.
Pleasure. And thank you for the thorough read and all the great questions.
The book by Benjamin Law is titled The Secret Life of Groceries. This is Scenic Roots.